that I hadn't inadvertently introduced any virulent bacteria into the meat broth mixture, and that, well, I could hope for a lot of things. But there came a point when one abandoned hope for faith and trusted fate for charity. A line of broth-filled bowls sat at the back of the countertop, each covered with a square of muslin to prevent things, insects, airborne particles, and mouse droppings, to say nothing of mice, from falling in. I had strained the broth and boiled it, then rinsed each bowl with boiling water before filling it with the steaming brown liquid. That was as close as I could come to a sterile medium. I had then taken scrapings from each of my best mould samples and swished the knife blade gently through the cooled broth, dissipating the clumps of soft blue as best I could, before covering the bowl with its cloth and leaving it to incubate for several days. Some of the cultures had thrived, others had died. A couple of bowls showed hairy dark green clumps that floated beneath the surface like submerged sea beasts, dark and sinister. Some intruder, mould, bacterium, or perhaps a colonial alga, but not the precious penicillium. Some anonymous child had spilled one bowl. Adzo had knocked another onto the floor, maddened by the scent of goose broth, and had lapped up the contents, mould and all, with every evidence of enjoyment. There obviously hadn't been anything toxic in that one. I glanced down at the little cat, curled up in a pool of sunshine on the floor, the picture of somnolent well-being. In three of the remaining bowls, though, spongy velvet mats of mottled blue covered the surface, and my examination of a sample taken from one of them had just confirmed that I did indeed have what I sought. It wasn't the mould itself that was antibiotic. It was a clear substance secreted by the mould as a means of protecting itself from attack by bacteria. That substance was penicillin, and that was what I wanted. I had explained as much to Jamie, who sat on a stool watching me as I poured the broth from each live culture through another bit of gauze to strain it.
"So what you've got there is broth that the mould has pissed in. Is that right?"
"Well, if you insist on putting it that way, yes." I gave him an austere glance, then took up the strained solution and began distributing it into several small stoneware jars. He nodded, pleased to have got it right.
"And the mould piss is what cures sickness, eh? That's sensible."
"It is."
"Well, you use other sorts of piss for medicine, so why not that?"
He lifted the big black casebook in illustration. I had left it open on the counter after recording the latest batch of experiments, and he'd been amusing himself by reading some of the earlier pages, those recorded by the book's previous owner, Dr. Daniel Rawlings.
"Possibly Daniel Rawlings did. I don't."
Hands busy, I lifted my chin at the entry on the open page. What was he using it for?
"Electuary for the treatment of scurvy," he read, finger following the neat small lines of Rawlings' script. 2 heads of garlic crushed with 6 radishes, to which are added Peru balsam and 10 drops of myrrh. This compound mixed with the water of a man-child so as to be conveniently drunk."
"Bar the last, it sounds like a rather exotic condiment," I said, amused.
"What would it go with best, do you think? Jugged hare? Ragout of veal?"
"Nay, veal's too mild flavour to radish. Hodgepodge of mutton, maybe," he replied. "Mutton will stand anything."
His tongue flicked absent-mindedly across his upper lip in contemplation.
"Why a man-child, you think, Sassenach? I've seen the mention of it in such receipts before. Aristotle has it so, and so have some of the other ancient philosophers."
I gave him a look as I began tidying up my slides.
"Well, it's certainly easier to collect urine from a male child than from a little girl. Just try it sometime. Oddly enough, though, urine from baby boys is very clean, if not entirely sterile. It may be that the ancient philosophers noticed they had better results with it in their formulae because it was cleaner than the usual drinking water, if they were getting that from public aqueducts and wells and the like."
"Sterile meaning that it hasn't got the germs in it, not that it doesn't breed."
He gave my microscope a rather wary glance. "Yes, or rather, it doesn't breed germs, because there aren't any there."
With the countertop cleared, save for the microscope and the jars of penicillin containing broth, or at least I hope that's what they were, I began the preparations for surgery, taking down my small case of surgical instruments and fetching a large bottle of grain alcohol out of the cupboard. I handed this to Jamie, along with a small alcohol burner I had contrived, an empty ink bottle with a twisted wick of waxed flax drawn up through a cork stuck into the neck. "Fill that up for me, will you? Where are the boys?"
"In the kitchen, getting drunk."
He frowned in concentration, carefully pouring the alcohol.
"Is the urine of wee lassies not clean, then? Or is it only harder to get?"
"No, actually it isn't as clean as that of boys." I unfolded a clean cloth on the countertop and laid out two scalpels, a pair of long-nosed forceps, and a bunch of small cautery irons. I dug about in the cupboard, unearthing a handful of cotton pledgets. Cotton cloth was hideously expensive, but I had had the good fortune to cajole a sack of raw cotton balls from Farquhar Campbell's wife in return for a jar of honey. The, route to the outside isn't quite so direct, you might say, so the urine tends to pick up bacteria and bits of debris from the skin folds. I looked over my shoulder at him and smiled. "Not that you ought to go feeling superior on that account."
"I shouldn't have dreamed of it," he assured me. "Are you ready then, Sassenach?"
"Yes. Fetch them in. Oh, and bring the basin." He went out, and I turned to face the east window. It had snowed heavily the day before, but today was a fine, bright day, clear and cold, with the sun reflecting off the snow-covered trees with the light of a million diamonds. I couldn't have asked for better. I should need all the light I could get. I set the cautery irons in the small brazier to heat. Then I fetched my amulet from the cabinet, put it round my neck so it hung beneath the bodice of my gown, and took down the heavy canvas apron from its hook behind the door. I put that on too, then went to the window and looked out at the cold icing sugar landscape, emptying my mind, steadying my spirit for what I was about to do. It wasn't a difficult operation, and I'd done it many times before. I had not, however, done it on someone who was sitting upright and conscious, and that always made a difference. I hadn't done it in several years either, and I closed my eyes in recollection, visualizing the steps to take, feeling the muscles of my hand twitch slightly in echo of my thoughts, anticipating the movements I would make. "God help me," I whispered, and crossed myself. Stumbling footsteps, nervous giggles, and the rumble of Jamie's voice came from the hallway, and I turned round, smiling, to greet my patients. A month of good food, clean clothes, and warm beds had improved the Beardsleys immensely in terms of both health and appearance. They were both still small, skinny, and slightly bow-legged, but the hollows of their faces had filled out a bit. Their dark hair lay soft against their skulls, and the look of hunted wariness had faded a little from their eyes. In fact, both pairs of dark eyes were presently a little glazed, and Lizzie was obliged to grab Keziah by the arm in order to prevent his stumbling over a stool. Jamie had Josiah gripped firmly by the shoulder. He steered the boy over to me, then set down the pudding basin he carried under his other arm. "All right, are you?" I smiled at Josiah, looking deep into his eyes, and squeezed his arm in reassurance. He swallowed hard and gave me a rather ghastly grin. He wasn't drunk enough not to be scared. I sat him down, chatting soothingly, wrapped a towel round his neck and set the basin on his knees. I hoped he wouldn't drop it. It was china, and the only large pudding basin we had. To my surprise, Lizzie came to stand behind him, putting her small hands on his shoulders. "Are you sure you want to stay, Lizzie?" I asked dubiously. "We can manage all right, I think." Jamie was thoroughly accustomed to blood and general carnage. I didn't think Lizzie could ever have seen anything beyond the common sorts of illness and perhaps a childbirth or two.
"Oh, no, ma'am. I'll stay."
She swallowed too, but set her small jaw bravely.
"I promised you and Kezia as I'd stay with them all through."
I glanced at Jamie, who lifted one shoulder in the hint of a shrug. "All right, then," I took one of the stoneware jars of penicillin broth, poured it into two cups, and gave one to each of the twins to drink. Stomach acid would likely inactivate most of the penicillin, but it would, I hoped, kill the bacteria in their throats. Following surgery, another dose washed over the raw surfaces might prevent infection. There was no way of knowing exactly how much penicillin there might be in the broth. I might be giving them massive doses, or too little to matter. At least I was reasonably sure that whatever penicillin was in the broth was presently active. I had no means of stabilizing the antibiotic, and no notion how long it might be potent. But, fresh as it was, the solution was bound to be medicinally active, and there was a good chance that the rest of the broth would remain usable for at least the next few days. I would make new cultures as soon as the surgery was complete. With luck, I could dose the twins regularly for 3 or 4 days and, with greater luck, thus prevent any infections.
Ooh, so you can drink the stuff, can you?
Jamie was eyeing me cynically over Josiah's head. I had injected him with penicillin following a gunshot injury a few years before, and he obviously now considered that I had done so with purely sadistic intent. I eyed him back.
You can?
Injectable penicillin is much more effective, particularly in the case of an active infection. However, I haven't any means of injecting it just at present, and this is meant to prevent them getting an infection, not to cure one. Now, if we're quite ready... I had thought that Jamie would restrain the patient, but both Lizzie and Josiah insisted that this wasn't necessary. Josiah would sit quite still, no matter what. Lizzie still gripped his shoulders, her face paler than his, and her small knuckles sharp and white. I had examined both boys at length the day before, but I had another quick look before starting, using a tongue depressor made out of a slip of ashwood. I showed Jamie how to use this to keep the tongue pressed out of my way, then took up forceps and scalpel, and drew a long breath. I looked deep into Josiah's dark eyes and smiled. I could see two tiny reflections of my face there, both looking pleasantly competent.
All right, then, I asked.
He couldn't speak, with a tongue depressor in his mouth, but made a good-natured sort of grunt that I took for assent. I needed to be quick, and I was. The preparations had taken hours, the operation no more than a few seconds. I seized one spongy red tonsil with the forceps, stretched it toward me, and made several small, quick cuts, deftly separating the layers of tissue. A trickle of blood was running out of the boy's mouth and down his chin, but nothing serious. I pulled the gobbet of flesh free, dropped it into the basin, and shifted my grip to the other tonsil where I repeated the process, only a trifle more slowly in consequence of working back-handed. The whole thing couldn't have taken more than 30 seconds per side. I drew the instruments out of Josiah's mouth, and he goggled at me, astonished. Then he coughed, gagged, leaned forward, and another small chunk of flesh bounced into the basin with a small splat, together with a quantity of bright red blood. I seized him by the nose and thrust his head back, stuffed pledgets into his mouth to absorb sufficient blood that I could see what I was doing, then snatched a small cautery iron and took care of the largest vessels. The smaller ones could clot and seal on their own. His eyes were watering ferociously, and his hands were clamped in a death grip on the basin, but he had neither moved nor made a sound. I hadn't expected that he would, after what I had seen when Jamie removed the brand from his thumb. Lizzie was still gripping his shoulders, her eyes tight shut. Jamie reached up and tapped her on the elbow, and her eyes sprang open.
"Here, Avernon. He's done. Take him and put him to his bed, aye?"
Josiah declined to go, though. Mute as his brother, he shook his head violently and sat down upon a stool where he sat, swaying and white-faced. He gave his brother a ghastly grin, his teeth outlined in blood. Lizzie hovered between the two boys, looking back and forth between them. Joe caught her eye and pointed firmly at Keziah, who had assumed the patient's stool with an outward show of fortitude, chin upraised. She patted Joe gently on the head, and went at once to take hold of Keziah's shoulders.
He turned his head and gave her a smile of remarkable sweetness, then bent his head and kissed her hand. Then he turned to me, shutting his eyes and opening his mouth. He looked just like a nestling begging for worms.
This operation was somewhat more complicated. His tonsils and adenoids were terribly enlarged and badly scarred from chronic infection. It was a bloody business. Both the towel and my apron were heavily splattered before I had done. I finished the cautery and looked closely at my patient, who was white as the snow outside and completely glassy-eyed.
"Are you all right?" I asked.
He couldn't hear me, but my concerned expression was clear enough. His mouth twitched in what I thought was a gallant effort to smile. He began to nod, then his eyes rolled up and he slid off the stool, ending with a crash at my feet.
Jamie caught the basin, rather neatly. I thought Lizzie might faint as well. There was blood everywhere. She did totter a little, but went obediently to sit down beside Josiah when I told her to.
Josiah sat looking on, squeezing Lizzie's hand fiercely, while Jamie and I picked up the pieces. Jamie gathered Keziah up in his arms. The boy lay limp and blood-stained, looking like a murdered child. Josiah rose to his feet, his eyes resting anxiously on his brother's unconscious body.
"It'll be all right," Jamie said to him in tones of complete confidence. "I told you, my wife is a great healer."
They all turned then and looked at me, smiling, Jamie, Lizzie, and Josiah. I felt as though I ought to take a bow, but contented myself with smiling too.
"It will be all right," I said, echoing Jamie. "Go and rest now."
The small procession left the room, more quietly than they had come in, leaving me to put away my instruments and tidy up. I felt very happy, glowing with the calm sort of satisfaction that attends successful work. I hadn't done this sort of thing for a long time. The exigencies and limitations of the 18th century precluded most surgeries, save those done in emergency. Without anaesthesia and antibiotic, elective surgery was simply too difficult and too dangerous. But now I had penicillin, at least. And it would be all right, I thought, humming to myself as I extinguished the flame of my alcohol lamp. I had felt it in their flesh, touching the boys as I worked. No germ would threaten them. No infection mar the cleanliness of my work. There was always luck in the practice of medicine, but the odds had shifted today in my favour.
"All shall be well," I quoted to Adso, who had silently materialised on the counter where he was industriously licking one of the empty bowls. "And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well."
The big black casebook lay open on the counter where Jamie had left it. I turned to the back pages where I had been recording the progress of my experiments and took up my quill. Later, after supper, I would write down the details of the surgery. For the moment, I paused, then wrote "Eureka" at the bottom of the page. Chapter 37. Mail Call. Fergus undertook his bi-monthly trip to Cross Creek in mid-February, returning with salt, needles, indigo, a few more miscellaneous necessities, and a bag full of mail. He arrived in mid-afternoon, so anxious to get back to Marsali that he stayed only long enough for a quick mug of beer, leaving Brianna and me to sort through the parcels, gloating over the bounty. There was a thick stack of newspapers from Wilmington and New Bern. A few from Philadelphia and Boston as well, sent by friends in the north to Jocasta Cameron, and thence forwarded on to us. I flipped through these. The most recent was dated 3 months prior. No matter. Newspapers were as good as novels in a place where reading material was almost literally scarcer than gold. Jocasta had also sent 2 issues of Brigham's Ladies' Book for Brianna. This being a periodical featuring drawings of fashionable London costumes and articles of interest to women of such tastes. "How to clean gold lace," Brianna read, arching one eyebrow as she opened one of these at random. "That's something everybody ought to know how to do for sure." "Look in the back," I advised her. "That's where they publish the articles about how to avoid catching gonorrhea and what to do about your husband's piles." other brow went up, making her look just like Jamie, presented with some highly questionable proposition.
"If my husband gave me gonorrhea, I think he could just worry about his own piles."
She turned several pages, and the eyebrows arched higher.
"A spur to Venus, this being a list of infallible remedies for fatigue of the male member."
I peered over her arm, my own eyebrows rising.
"Goodness! A dozen of oysters soaked overnight in a mixture of wine and milk, to be baked in a tart with crushed almonds and lobster meat, and served with spiced peppers. I don't know what it would do for the male member, but it would probably give the gentleman attached to it violent indigestion. Of course, we haven't got any oysters here anyway." "No loss," she assured me, frowning at the page in concentration. "Oysters remind me of big plugs of snot."
"That's only the raw ones. They're more or less edible when cooked. Speaking of snot, though, where's Jemmy?"
"Asleep. Or at least I hope so."
She cast a suspicious eye toward the ceiling, but no untoward noises manifested themselves, and she returned to the page.
"Here's one we could do. The testicles of a male animal, like you get them from a female animal, taken with 6 large mushrooms and boiled in sour ale until tender. Then both testicles and mushrooms to be sliced thin, well peppered and seasoned with salt, then sprinkled with vinegar and browned before the fire until crusty. Da hasn't gotten around to castrating Gideon yet, has he?"
"No. I'm sure he'd be happy to give you the objects in question, if you want to try." She went very pink in the face, and cleared her throat with a noise that reminded me even more of her father.
"I am... don't think we need that just yet."
I laughed and left her to her fascinated perusal, turning back to the mail. There was a wrapped object addressed to Jamie that I knew must be a book, sent from a bookseller in Philadelphia, but with Lord John Grey's seal affixed, a daub of blue wax whimsically marked with a smiling half-moon and a single star. Half our library came from John Grey, who insisted that he sent us books primarily for his own satisfaction, as he knew no one in the colonies, other than Jamie, who was capable of carrying on a decent discussion of literature. There were several letters addressed to Jamie, too. I looked these over carefully, in hopes of seeing his sister's characteristic spiky script, but no such luck. There was a letter from Ian, who wrote faithfully once a month, but nothing from Jenny. There had been no word from her in the past 6 months, not since Jamie had written reluctantly to tell her of the fate of her youngest son. I frowned, setting the letters in a small stack at the edge of the desk for Jamie's later attention. I could scarcely blame Jenny, under the circumstances, but I'd been there after all. It hadn't been Jamie's fault, even though he'd accepted the blame for it. Young Ian had chosen to stay with the Mohawk. He was a man, if a young one, and the decision was his to make. But then, I reflected, he had been still a lad when he left his parents, and likely still was, so far as Jenny was concerned. I knew that her silence hurt Jamie deeply, though. He continued to write to her, as he always had, stubbornly putting down a few paragraphs most evenings, putting by the pages until someone should be going down from the mountain to Cross Creek or Wilmington. He was never obvious about it, but I saw the way his eyes flicked across each batch of letters, looking for her writing, and the almost invisible tightening at the corner of his mouth when he didn't find it.
"Drat you, Jenny Murray," I murmured under my breath. "Forgive him and have done with it."
Priyana had put down the periodical and was examining a square letter, frowning as she did so.
"Nothing. What's that you have there?"
I put down the letters I had been sorting and came to look.
"It's from Lieutenant Hayes. What do you think he's writing about?"
A tiny spurt of adrenaline tightened my belly. It must also have shone on my unwary face, for Brianna put down the letter and looked at me, brow furrowed.
"What?" she demanded.
"Nothing," I said. But it was too late. She stood looking at me, a fist doubled on her hip, and raised one brow.
"You are the most terrible liar, Mama," she said tolerantly.
Without hesitation, she broke the seal.
"That's addressed to your father," I said,
though my protest lacked strength.
"Mm-hmm. So was the other one," she said, head bent over the unfolded sheet of paper.
"What?" But I had come to her side and was reading over her arm even as I spoke.
"Lieutenant Archibald Hayes, Portsmouth, Virginia. Mr. James Fraser, Fraser's Ridge, North Carolina, January 18, 1771. Sir, I write to inform you that we are at present in Portsmouth and like to remain here until spring. If you are acquainted with any sea captains willing to grant passage to Perth for 40 men on promise of recompense from the army once port is reached, I should be glad to hear of it at your earliest convenience. In the meantime, we have put our hands to various labours that we might sustain ourselves through the winter months. Several of my men have obtained work in the repair of boats, which are plentiful here. I myself am employed as cook in a local tavern, but make shift to visit my men regularly in the assorted quarters where they are lodged, to make myself acquainted with their state. I called upon one such lodging 2 evenings ago. In course of conversation, one of the men, a Private Ogilvy, whom I think you will know, mentioned to me a conversation which he had overheard at the shipyard. As this pertained to one Stephen Bonnet, who, I recollect, is of interest to you, I pass on herewith the intelligence of the matter. Bonnet appears by report to be a smuggler, scarce an uncommon occupation in the area. However, he seems to deal in a higher quality and quantity of contraband than is the usual, and in consequence, the nature of his connections appears also unusual. Which is to say that certain warehouses on the Carolina coast periodically contain goods of a nature not generally to be found therein, and that such visitations coincide with sightings of Stephen Bonnet in the taverns and halls nearby. Private Ogilvy has little recollection of specific names overheard, as he had no knowledge that Bonnet was of interest, and mentioned the matter to me only as a curious piece of information. One name mentioned was Butler, he says, but he is uncertain whether this name had aught to do with Bonnet. Another name was Karen, but Ogilvy doesn't know whether this pertained to a woman or perhaps to a ship. A warehouse which he supposed to be a particular building indicated in the conversation, though he freely admits that he is uncertain of this, happened to be at no great distance from the shipyard, and when he told me of his intelligence, I took it upon myself to pass by this building and make inquiries concerning its ownership. The building is owned jointly by 2 partners, one Ronald Priestley and one Philip Wiley. I have no information concerning either man at present, but will continue my inquiries as my time permits. Having learned the above, I've made an effort to solicit conversation concerning Bonnet in the local tap rooms, but to little effect. I should say that the name is known, but few wish to speak of him. Your most obedient servant, Archibald Hayes, Lieutenant, 67th Highland Regiment. All the normal noises of the house were still around us, but Bree and I seemed suddenly to be together in a small, clear bubble of silence, where time had abruptly stopped. I felt reluctant to put down the letter, for that would mean that time would go on, and something must, at that point, be done. At the same time, I wanted not merely to put it down, but to throw it in the fire, and pretend neither of us had seen it. Then Jemmy began to cry upstairs. Brianna jerked in response and turned toward the door, and things began to move normally again. I sat the letter down in a space by itself, and returned to the rest of the mail, setting things tidily aside for Jamie's later attention, putting the newspapers and periodicals into a neat stack, untying the string round the parcel. As I had supposed, it was a book, Tobias Smollett's The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker. I wound up the string and tucked it into my pocket, while all the time a small now what, beat in the back of my mind like a metronome. Brianna came back, carrying Jemmy, who was red and creased from his nap, and obviously in that state of mind where one rouses from sleep to a dazed irritation at the intrusive demands of consciousness. I sympathised. She sat down, pulled down the neck of her shift,
and put the baby to her breast. His cries ceased like magic, and I had a moment of intense wishfulness that I could do something that immediately effective for her. As it was, she looked pale but composed. I had to say something. "I am sorry, sweetheart," I said. "I tried to stop him, Jamie, I mean. I know he didn't mean you to know about it, to worry about it." "That's okay. I already knew." Reaching across one-handed, she slid one of the ledgers out of the stack Jamie kept on his desk and, holding it by the spine, shook out a folded letter. She nodded over Jamie's head at it. "Look at that. I found it while you were gone with the militia." I read Lord John's account of the duel between Bonnet and Captain Marsden, feeling a coldness gather beneath my breastbone. I hadn't been under any illusions regarding Bonnet's character, but I hadn't known that he had that much skill. I greatly preferred dangerous criminals to being competent. "I thought maybe Lord John was just answering a casual question for Dar, but I guess not." "What do you think?" Bree asked. Her tone was cool, almost detached, as though she were inquiring my opinion of a hair ribbon or a shoe buckle. I looked up at her sharply. "What do you think?" It was Brianna who was important in this. Well, that was my opinion. "About what?" Her eyes slid away from mine, glancing off the letter, then fastening themselves on the curve of Jemmy's head. "Oh, the price of tea in China, for starters," I said with some irritation. "Going on promptly to the topic of Stephen Bonnet, if you like." It felt oddly shocking to say the name out loud. We had all avoided it for months by unspoken consent. Her teeth were fastened in her lower lip. She kept her eyes fixed on the floor for a moment, then shook her head very slightly. "I don't want to hear about him or think about him," she said very evenly. "And if I ever see him again, I might just... She shuddered violently, then looked up at me, eyes fierce and sudden. "What's wrong with him?" she cried. "How could he do this?" Her clenched fist struck her thigh, and Jemmy, startled, lost his grip and began to wail. "Your father, you mean, not Bonnet." She nodded, pressing Jemmy back toward her breast, but he had picked up her agitation and was squirming and howling. I reached down and took him, hoisting him to my shoulder and patting his back in automatic comfort. Bree's hands, left empty, fastened on her knees, crumpled the cloth of her skirt. "Why couldn't he leave Bonnet alone?" She had to raise her voice to be heard above the baby's wailing, and the bones of her face seemed to have shifted so that the skin looked tight drawn over them. "Because he's a man and a bloody Highlander," I said. "Live and let live is not in their vocabulary." Milk was dripping slowly from her nipple onto the fabric of her shift. I reached out one-handed and tweaked the cloth up to cover her. She put a hand over her breast and pressed hard to stop the milk. "What does he mean to do, though, if he finds him?" "When he finds him, I'm afraid," I said reluctantly, "because I don't believe he's going to stop looking until he does. As to what he'll do then, well, then he'll kill him, I suppose." It sounded oddly offhand put that way, and yet I didn't see any other way of putting it, really. "You mean he'll try to kill him?" She glanced at the letter from Lord John, then away, swallowing. "What if he..." "Your father has a great deal of experience in killing people," I said bleakly. "In fact, he's awfully good at it, though he hasn't done it for some time." This didn't seem to reassure her to any great extent. It hadn't reassured me either. "It's such a big place," she murmured, shaking her head. "America, I mean. Why couldn't he just go away, far away?" An excellent question. Jemmy was snorting, rubbing his face vigorously in my shoulder, but no longer screaming. I was rather hoping that Stephen Bonnet would have the good sense to go and pursue his smuggling in China or the West Indies. But I suppose he has local connections that he didn't want to abandon. I shrugged, patting Jemmy, Brianna let go of her skirt and reached for the baby, who was still twisting like an eel.
Well, he doesn't know he has Sherlock Fraser and his sidekick Lord John Watson on his trail, after all.
It was a brave try, but her lip trembled as she said it, and she bit the lower one again.
I hated to cause her more worry, but there was no point now in avoiding things.
No, but he very likely will, before too long, I said reluctantly.
Lord John is very discreet. Private Ogilvy isn't. If Jamie goes on asking questions, and he will, I'm afraid, his interest is going to be rather widely known before long.
I wasn't sure whether Jamie had hoped to discover Bonnet quickly and take him unawares, or whether his plan was to smoke Bonnet out into the open by means of his inquiries, or whether he meant, in fact, to draw Bonnet's attention deliberately and cause him to come to us. The last possibility made me a little weak in the knees, and I sat down heavily on the stool.
Brianna drew a slow, deep breath and let it out through her nose, settling the baby back at her breast.
Does Roger know? I mean, is he in on this bloody vendetta?
I shook my head.
I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure not. He would have told you, wouldn't he?
Her expression eased a little, though a shadow of doubt still darkened her eyes.
I'd hate to think he'd keep something like that from me. On the other hand, she added, voice sharpening a little in accusation, you did.
I felt the sting of it and pressed my lips tight together.
You said that you didn't want to think of Stephen Bonnet, I said, looking away from the turbulence of feeling in her face. Naturally not. We didn't want you to have to.
With a certain feeling of inevitability, I realised that I was being drawn into the vortex of Jamie's intentions, through no consent of my own.
Now look, I said briskly, sitting up straight and giving Brianna a sharp look. I don't think it's a good idea to look for Bonnet, and I've done all I could to discourage Jamie from doing it. In fact, I added ruefully, with a nod toward Lord John's letter, I thought I had discouraged him, but apparently not.
A look of determination was hardening Brianna's mouth, and she settled herself more solidly in the chair.
I'll bloody discourage him, she said.
I gave her a look, considering.
If anyone had the necessary stubbornness and force of character to sway Jamie from his chosen path, it would be his daughter. That was, however, a very large if. You can try, I said, a little dubiously. Don't I have the right?
Her initial shock had vanished, and her features were back under control, her expression cold and hard.
Isn't it for me to say whether I want what I want?
Yes, I agreed, a twinge of uneasiness rippling down my back. Fathers were inclined to think they had rights too. So were husbands. But perhaps that was better left unsaid. A momentary silence fell between us, broken only by Jemmy's noises and the calling of crows outside. Almost by impulse, I asked the question that had risen to the surface of my mind.
Brianna, what do you want? Do you want Stephen Bonnet dead?
She glanced at me, then away, looking out the window while she patted Jemmy's back. She didn't blink. Finally, her eyes closed briefly, then opened to meet mine.
I can't, she said, low-voiced. I'm afraid if I ever let that thought in my mind, I'd never be able to think about anything else. I'd want it so much. And I will be damned if I let him ruin my life that way.
Jemmy gave a resounding belch and spit up a little milk. Bree had an old linen towel across her shoulder and deftly wiped his chin with it. Calmer now, he had lost his look of vexed incomprehension and was concentrating intently on something over his mother's shoulder. Following the direction of his clear blue gaze, I saw the shadow of a spider web high up in the corner of the window. A gust of wind shook the window frame, and a tiny spot moved in the centre of the web, very slightly. Yeah, Brianna said, very softly. I do want him dead. But I want Da and Roger alive more.
This ends Disc 19. The Fiery Cross, Disc 20.
Chapter 38. The Dream Time. Roger had gone to sing for Joel McLeod's nephew's wedding, as arranged at gathering, and come home with a new prize, which he was anxious to commit to paper before it should escape. He left his muddy boots in the kitchen, accepted a cup of tea and a raisin tart from Mrs. Bug, and went directly to the study. Jamie was there, writing letters. He glanced up with an absent murmur of acknowledgement, but then returned to his composition, a slight frown between his heavy brows as he formed the letters, hand cramped and awkward on the quill. There was a small three-shelf bookcase in Jamie's study, which held the entire library of Fraser's Ridge. The serious works occupied the top shelf, a volume of Latin poetry, Caesar's Commentaries, the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, a few other classic works. Dr. Brickell's Natural History of North Carolina, lent by the governor and never returned, and a schoolbook on mathematics, much abused, with Ian Murray the Younger written on the flyleaf in a staggering hand. The middle shelf was given over to more light-minded reading, a small selection of romances, slightly ragged, with much reading, featuring Robinson Crusoe, Tom Jones, in a set of 7 small leather-covered volumes, Roderick Random, in 4 volumes, and Sir Henry Richardson's Monstrous Pamela, done in 2 gigantic octavo bindings. The first of these, decorated with multiple bookmarks, ranging from a ragged dried maple leaf to a folded pen wiper, these indicating the points which various readers had reached before giving up, either temporarily or permanently. A copy of Don Quixote in Spanish, ratty but much less worn, since only Jamie could read it. The bottom shelf held a copy of Dr. Sam Johnson's dictionary, Jamie's ledgers and account books, several of Brianna's sketchbooks, and the slender buckram-bound journal in which Roger recorded the words of unfamiliar songs and poems acquired at Cayley's and Hearthside's. He took a stool on the other side of the table Jamie used as a desk and cut a new quill for the job, taking care with it. He wanted these records to be readable. He didn't know precisely what use the collection might be put to, but he had been ingrained with the scholar's instinctive value for the written word. Perhaps this was only for his own pleasure and use, but he liked the feeling that he might be leaving something to posterity as well, and took pains both to write clearly and to document the circumstances under which he had acquired each song. The study was peaceful, with no more than Jamie's occasional sigh as he stopped to rub the kinks from his cramped hand. After a while, Mr. Bug came to the door, and after a brief colloquy, Jamie put away his quill and went out with the factor. Roger nodded vaguely as they bade him farewell, mind occupied with the effort of recall and recording. When he finished, a quarter of an hour later, his mind was pleasantly empty, and he sat back, stretching the ache from his shoulders. He waited a few moments for the ink to be thoroughly dry before he put the book away, and while waiting, went to pull out one of Brianna's sketchbooks from the bottom shelf. She wouldn't mind if he looked. She'd told him he was welcome to look at them. At the same time, she showed him only the occasional drawing, those she was pleased with or had done especially for him. He turned over the pages of the notebook, feeling the sense of curiosity and respect that attends the prying into mystery, searching for small glimpses of the workings of her mind. There were lots of portrait sketches of the baby in this one, a study in circles. He paused at one small sketch, caught by memory. It was a sketch of Jemmy, sleeping, back turned, his small, sturdy body curled up in a comma. Adso the cat was curled up beside him in precisely similar fashion, his chin perched on Jemmy's fat little foot, eyes slits of comatose bliss. He remembered that one. She drew Jemmy often, nearly every day, in fact, but seldom full face. "Babies don't really have faces," she told him, frowning critically at her offspring, who was industriously gnawing on the leather strap of Jamie's powder horn. "Why?
And what's that on the front of his head, then?
He had lain flat on the floor with the baby and the cat, grinning up at her, which made it easier for her to look down her nose at him.
I mean, strictly speaking. Naturally, they have faces, but they all look alike.
It's a wise father that kens his own child, eh? He joked,
regretting it instantly as he saw the shadow cloud her eyes. It passed, quick as a summer cloud, but it had been there, nonetheless.
Well, not from an artist's point of view.
She drew the blade of her penknife at an angle across the tip of the charcoal stick, sharpening the point.
They don't have any bones, that you can see, I mean. And it's the bones that you use to show the shape of a face. Without bones, there isn't much there.
Bones or not, she had a remarkable knack for capturing the nuances of expression. He smiled at one sketch. Jemmy's face wore the aloof and unmistakable expression of one concentrating hard on the production of a truly terrible diaper. Beyond the pictures of Jemmy, there were several pages of what looked like engineering diagrams.
Finding these of no great interest, he bent and replaced the book, then drew out another.
He realized at once that it wasn't a sketchbook. The pages were dense with Brianna's tidy, angular writing. He flipped curiously through the pages. It wasn't really a diary, but appeared to be a sort of record of her dreams. Last night I dreamed that I shaved my legs.
Roger smiled at the inconsequence, but a vision of Brianna's shins, long-boned and glimmering, kept him reading.
I was using Daddy's razor and his shaving cream, and I was thinking that he'd complain when he found out,
but I wasn't worried.
The shaving cream came in a white can with red letters, and it said Old Spice on the label. I don't know if there ever was shaving cream like that, but that's what Daddy always smelled of. Old Spice aftershave and cigarette smoke. He didn't smoke, but the people he worked with did, and his jackets always smelled like the air in the living room after a party. Roger breathed in, half conscious of the remembered scents of fresh baking and tea, furniture polish and ammonia.
No cigarettes at the decorous gatherings held in the manse's parlour. Yet his father's jackets, too, had smelled of smoke.
Once Gail told me that she'd gone out with Chris and hadn't had time to shave her legs, and she spent the whole evening trying to keep him from putting his hand on her knee for fear he'd feel the stubble. Afterward, I never shaved my legs without thinking of that, and I'd run my fingers up my thigh to see whether I could feel anything there, or if it was okay to stop shaving at my kneecaps. The hair on Brianna's thighs was so fine it couldn't be felt, and only seen when she rose up naked over him, with the sun behind her gilding her body, gleaming through that delicate nimbus of secrecy. The thought that no one would ever see it but himself gave him a small glow of satisfaction, like a miser counting each hair of gold and copper, enjoying his secret fortune undisturbed by any fear of theft. He turned the page, feeling unspeakably guilty at this intrusion, yet drawn irresistibly by the urge to penetrate the intimacy of her dreams, to know the images that filled her sleeping mind. The entries were undated, but each entry began with the same words. Last night, I dreamed. Last night I dreamed that it was raining. Hardly surprising, since it was raining and has been for 2 days. When I went out to the privy this morning, I had to jump over a huge puddle by the door and sank up to the ankles in the soft spot by the blackberries. We went to bed last night with the rain pounding on the roof. It was so nice to curl up with Roger and be warm in our bed after a wet, chilly day. Raindrops fell down the chimney and hissed in the fire. We told each other stories from our youths. Maybe that's where the dream came from, thinking about the past. There wasn't much to the dream, just that I was looking out a window in Boston, watching the cars go past, throwing up big sheets of water from their wheels and hearing the swoosh and rush of their tires on the wet streets. I woke up still hearing that sound. It was so clear in my mind that I actually went to the window and peeked out, half expecting to see a busy street full of cars rushing through the rain. It was a shock to see spruce trees and chestnuts and wild grass and creepers,
and hear nothing but the soft patter of raindrops bouncing and trembling on the burdock leaves. Everything was so vivid a green, so lush and overgrown, that it seemed like a jungle or an alien planet, a place I'd never been, with nothing I recognized, though in fact I see it every day. All day I've heard the secret rush of tires in the rain somewhere behind me. Feeling guilty but fascinated, Roger turned the page. Last night I dreamed of driving my car. It was my own blue Mustang, and I was driving fast down a winding road through the mountains, these mountains. I've never driven through these mountains, though I have been through the mountain woodlands in upstate New York. It was definitely here, though. I knew it was the ridge. It was so real. I can still feel my hair snapping in the wind, the wheel in my hands, the vibration of the motor and the rumble of tires on the pavement. But that sensation, as well as the car, is impossible. Can't happen now anywhere but in my head. And yet there it is, embedded in the cells of my memory, as real as the privy outside, waiting to be called back to life at the flick of a synapse. That's another oddness. Nobody knows what a synapse is except me and Mama and Roger. What a strange feeling, as though we three share all kinds of secrets. Anyway, that particular bit, the driving, is traceable to a known memory. But what about the dreams, equally vivid, equally real, of things I do not know of my waking self? Are some dreams the memories of things that haven't happened yet? Last night I dreamed that I made love with Roger. He'd been about to close the book, feeling a sense of guilt at his intrusion. The guilt was still there, in spades, but totally insufficient to overcome his curiosity. He glanced at the door, but the house was quiet. Women were moving about in the kitchen, but no one was near the study. Last night I dreamed that I made love with Roger. It was great. For once I wasn't thinking, wasn't watching from the outside like I always do. In fact, I wasn't even aware of myself for a long time. It was just this very wild, exciting stuff. And I was part of it. And Roger was part of it. But there wasn't any him or me. Just us. The funny thing is that it was Roger. But I didn't think of him like that. Not by his name. Not that name. It was like he had another name, a secret, real one. But I knew what it was. I've always thought everybody has that kind of name, the kind that isn't a word. I know who I am. And whoever it is, her name isn't Brianna. It's me, that's all. Me works fine as a substitute for what I mean. But how do you write down someone else's secret name? I knew Roger's real name, though. And that seemed to be why it was working. And it really was working, too. I didn't think about it or worry about it, and I only thought toward the very end, hey, it's happening. And then it did happen, and everything dissolved and shook and throbbed. Here she had blacked out the rest of the line with a small cross note in the margin that said, "Well, none of the books I've ever read could describe it either." Despite his shocked fascination, Roger laughed aloud, then choked it off, glancing round hastily to see that he was still alone. There were noises in the kitchen, but no sound of footsteps in the hall, and his eyes went back to the page like iron filings drawn to a magnet. I had my eyes closed, in the dream, that is. And I was lying there with little electric shocks still going off. And I opened my eyes and it was Stephen Bonnet inside me. It was such a shock it woke me up. I felt like I'd been screaming. My throat was all raw. But I couldn't have been, because Roger and the baby were sound asleep. I was hot all over, so hot I was sweating. But I was cold too, and my heart was pounding. It took a long time before things settled down enough for me to go back to sleep. All the birds were carrying on. That's what finally let me go back to sleep, in fact. The birds. Da
and Daddy, too, come to think of it, told me that the jays and crows give alarm calls, but songbirds stop singing when someone comes near. So when you're in a forest, you listen for that. With so much racket in the trees by the house, I knew it was safe. Nobody was there. There was a small blank space at the foot of the page. He turned it, feeling his palms sweat and his heartbeat heavy in his ears. The writing resumed at the top of the page. Before, the writing had been fluid, almost hasty, the letters flattened as they raced across the page. Here, they were formed with more care, rounded and upright, as though the first shock of the experience were spent, and she had returned, with a stubborn caution, to think further about it. I tried to forget it, but that didn't work. It kept coming back and coming back into my mind, so I finally went out by myself to work in the herb shed. Mama keeps Jimmy when I'm there because he gets in things, so I knew I could be alone. So I sat down in the middle of all the hanging bunches and closed my eyes and tried to remember every single thing about it and think to myself about the different parts. That's okay, or that's just a dream. Because Stephen Bonnet scared me, and I felt sick when I thought of the end. But I really wanted to remember how it felt and how I did it. So maybe I can do it again with Roger. But I keep having this feeling that I can't, unless I can remember Roger's secret name. There, the entry stopped. The dreams continued on the next page, but Roger didn't read further. He closed the book very carefully and slid it back behind the others on the shelf. He rose to his feet and stood looking out the window for some time, unconsciously rubbing his sweating palms over the seams of his breeches. Part 5. 'Tis better to marry than burn. Chapter 39. In Cupid's Grove.
Do you think they'll share a bed?
Jamie didn't raise his voice, but he made no effort to lower it either. Luckily, we were standing at the far end of the terrace, too far away for the bridal couple to hear. A number of heads turned in our direction, though. Ninian Bell Hamilton was openly staring at us. I smiled brightly and fluttered my closed fan at the elderly Scotsman in greeting, meanwhile giving Jamie a swift nudge in the ribs. "A nice, respectable sort of thing for a nephew to be wondering about his aunt," I said under my breath. Jamie shifted out of elbow range and lifted an eyebrow at me.
"What's respectable to do with it? They'll be married. And well above the age of consent, both of them," he added with a grin at Ninian, who went bright pink with smothered mirth.
I didn't know how old Duncan Innes was, but my best guess put him in his mid-50s. Jamie's Aunt Jocasta had to be at least a decade older. I could just see Jocasta over the heads of the intervening crowd, graciously accepting the greetings of friends and neighbours at the far end of the terrace. A tall woman, gowned in russet wool, she was flanked by huge stone vases holding sprays of dried goldenrod, and her black butler, Ulysses, stood at her shoulder, dignified in wig and green livery. With an elegant white lace cap crowning her bold Mackenzie bones, she was undeniably the queen of River Run Plantation. I stood on tiptoe, searching for her consort. Duncan was slightly shorter than Jocasta, but he should still have been visible. I'd seen him earlier in the morning dressed in an absolute blaze of Highland finery, in which he looked dashing, if terribly self-conscious. I craned my neck, putting a hand on Jamie's arm to keep my balance. He grabbed my elbow to steady me.
"What are you looking for, Sasnach?"
"Duncan, shouldn't he be with your aunt?" No one could tell by looking that Jocasta was blind, that she stood between the big vases to keep her bearings, or that Ulysses was there to whisper in her ear the names of approaching guests. I saw her left hand drift outward from her side, touch empty air, and drift back. Her face didn't change, though. She smiled and nodded, saying something to Judge Henderson. "Run away before the wedding night," suggested Ninian, lifting his chin and both eyebrows in an effort to see over the crowd without standing on his toes. I'd maybe feel a bit nervous at the prospect myself. Your aunt's a handsome woman, Fraser, but she